for listening to A Little More Conversation. I'm Ben O'Hara-Berg. Tonight, we find out how a daughter-father fossil-hunting duo in Britain unearthed part of a fossilized jawbone from what could well be the largest marine reptile ever known, even bigger than a blue whale. So what was it? How did it live? And when did it go extinct? We find out. A report this weekend suggests the Trudeau government is leaning on last week's federal budget with all its attention on Gen Z and millennials and trying to help with the affordability crisis to turn around their sinking fortunes in the polls, looking to make up about 5 points in their double-digit deficit to the Conservatives every 6 months, according to the Globe and Mail. So have they gotten a post-budget bump? We'll find out. We look into whether or not they've gotten a post-budget bump. One group that was left angry by the budget was disability advocates across the country. The newly announced federal disability benefit falls far short of expectations, offering just an extra $200 a month to some 600,000 Canadians living with disabilities. Too little to too few, say critics, including Michael Prince, who's resigned from a ministerial advisory board in protest. He joins me to explain why. But first, Toronto police today have called in the Ontario Provincial Police to review how the force handled the case of Umar Zamir. The 34-year-old was acquitted of first-degree murder on Sunday in the death of Detective Constable Jeffrey Northrup in a case that centered not on whether Zamir had caused the officer's death by striking him with his car in an underground parking garage in July 2021, but whether he knew the plainclothes officers approaching his car were in fact police, and if he could see Northrup as he tried to drive away. The review was prompted in part by the trial judge questioning the accuracy of police testimony in the case, which was contradicted by expert and video evidence. Criminal lawyer Monty McGregor is with me to explain. Let's begin tonight in Toronto, where Game 3 goes later in the week. And new developments late today following the acquittal Sunday of a 34-year-old man in connection with the death of a Toronto police officer in 2021. Toronto police are turning to the OPP, the Ontario Provincial Police, to conduct an independent review. Umar Zamir had been charged with first-degree murder after 54-year-old Detective Constable Jeffrey Northrup was struck and killed by a vehicle driven by Zamir in the underground parking lot at Toronto City Hall in July of 2021. Now, the jury returned the verdict on its fourth day of deliberations, not guilty. Zamir spoke to reporters outside the courthouse.
I never meant any of this to happen. I am sorry for what had happened, but I never meant any of this to happen to this day.
The fact that Zamir ran over Northrup and caused his death was not in dispute. The case really centered on whether Zamir, who had his 8-month pregnant wife and young son in his car at the time, meant to hit the 31-year veteran, and whether he knew Northrup and his partner were plainclothes police officers. The officer had rushed the vehicle alongside his partner, Lisa Forbes, both in plainclothes, while investigating a stabbing that had just taken place nearby. Now, the court heard that Zamir thought he and his family were being attacked, and he tried to quickly drive away. The trial judge, Justice Anne Molloy, offered the 34-year-old an apology for his troubles yesterday. Zamir, you're free to go, sir, she said. You have my deepest apologies for what you've been through. Zamir's defense lawyer, Nader Hassan, says police should learn from this case.
Look, I do think that this case will mark a teachable moment for many police agencies, for many Canadians, about how we want police to act, how they should act, especially when they're in plain clothes.
Toronto Police Chief Myron Demkew told reporters yesterday outside the courthouse that this has been a difficult time for the Toronto policing community, and even that he had hoped for a different outcome.
While we respect the judicial process and appreciate the work of everyone involved in this very difficult case, I share the feelings of our members. We were hoping for a different outcome. Now, we will come together as a policing family during this difficult time.
But there are a lot of questions tonight as to why this case ever went to trial the way it did as a first-degree murder charge, when a lot of the evidence, apparently, from within the garage itself pointed to what it was, a tragic accident, at least as far as the jury was concerned, not an intentional act. Joining me now is Monty McGregor. He's a criminal lawyer and partner at Rozanek, O'Connor, Robbins, Ross, and Angelini in Toronto. Monty, thank you.
Excellent. Thanks for having me on time or on board.
There you have it. A lot of questions tonight. I guess there is a lot of hindsight about this case in particular. Perhaps just to begin at the beginning and your reaction to the acquittal, to the verdict.
It was absolutely appropriate, given the nature of the evidence and the case that was prosecuted. I think that's the consensus amongst everyone I know in the criminal justice system. That includes judges, that includes defense lawyers, that includes other Crown attorneys, that based on the way the case was presented, at its highest, it may have been a degree of dangerous driving, but it's clearly built on the premise that he was, Mr. Zamir was under the mistaken belief that the officers were either robbers or assailants, that he was in danger. And when he chose to flee, sadly, without knowing it at the time, he brushed Officer Northrup, dragged him under the car and ran over him. It's an absolute tragedy, but it's the right verdict. He wasn't guilty in my mind.
Right. Take me back perhaps to that night of July 2nd, 2021, because the circumstances, the entire case is so tragic because you see, of course, the death of the officer, which in of itself, you can understand how the police force was affected. He leaves behind a family and so on. On the other side of this, Mr. Zamir, who again was, happened to be out on a night with his pregnant wife and their family going to see Canada Day festivities. I mean, it seemed like everything that night was just tragic, really.
It's the perfect storm of like the constellation of all the tragic events as you look at it, because and when you initially hear, and when he was first arrested and released on bail without knowing anything about the circumstances, everybody was up in arms about why he was being released, if an officer's dead. But really, as you drill into the specifics, you start to see just how it was so unfortunate for all involved, because Mr. Zamir is a 30-year-old new Canadian who's an accountant with no criminal record. He's out enjoying Canada Day. This is just after midnight on Canada Day when he is with his 8.5 month pregnant wife, his 2-year-old son. They've just gotten ice cream in Nathan Phillips Square, right downtown Toronto, and they go to depart and they go into the underground of the parking lot. And at this time, unbeknownst to them, the police have gotten a description that there's been a stabbing and they're looking for a stabber. So the undercover officers start to go into the garage looking for this individual that they think has committed a crime. And sadly, I don't know where the disconnect here was, because given the nature of the description of the stabber, a homeless individual that's somewhat bedraggled, that may have ripped clothes and blood on them, they pick Mr. Zamir, who is in a $90,000 BMW with his young son in the back seat and his pregnant wife. And unfortunately, given the look of them, and I've seen lots of undercover officers in my 20-year career, you would never look at these individuals and think they were the police. They come quickly onto the vehicle. They start to strike it and say, demand to get out. Mr. Zamir, who's had come from Malaysia, born in Pakistan. We had just had the Veltman incident in London, sadly, where the family had been run over because they were Muslim, wearing a hijab, just like his wife. They tried to drive forward to escape the two assailants. And what happens? An undercover vehicle where you'd never think it was the police locks them in, causing him to respond. I mean, and I know Mr. Zamir said, what would have happened if, in my discussions with him, what would have happened if I had have left 5 minutes sooner or left 5 minutes later? Like, none of this would have occurred. And just the perfect storm of everything going wrong to cause this sad, tragic event.
And at trial, there was never the facts of the case were never in dispute that Mr. Zamir had caused the officer's death. That was not in dispute. What was disputed was whether it was intentional or not, right? And what the jury came back with was not just an acquittal on the first degree murder charge, which would suggest, I mean, I know there are nuances here anytime an officer is killed in the line of duty, but also was acquitted of anything else involving what happened that night. Really, it was seen to have been a tragic mistake, an accident.
That's right. And if you look at it pretty simply, the way he would have been guilty of first degree murder is if he intended to drive over the individual knowing it was a police officer. So you sort of knock off the knowledge that it's a police officer. Then you move into second degree murder, which would be the intention to cause bodily harm. Again, knowing that the individual is there and you drive over them anyways. Drops into a manslaughter consideration when you say, let's look, focus on the driving. Was the driving dangerous under the circumstances that he was under? And the jury found him not guilty of anything. And I think what was really controversial was that the three eyewitness police officers provided information that made it look like Officer Northrup was standing visible in front of the car when he drove forward and struck him. That was clearly contradicted by the video surveillance evidence within the parking garage. It was contradicted by the Crown Attorney's own expert crash reconstructionist, who said, no, there was no evidence on the front of the vehicle that there was any damage or dusting of it, which what can happen is when somebody runs into an object, it sort of clears off the debris on the front of the vehicle. That was all on the side, the front driver's side panel, which made it look like as he was reversing, he sort of dragged him under, and sadly, Officer Northrup would have been completely within a blind spot, unavailable for Mr. Zamir to see while he was driving. And then the question is, well, did he drive in a dangerous way? Well, if he had have seen the officer at the time, I think there would have been a much greater likelihood of conviction. But the jury agreed that under the circumstances, I mean, he was only driving 17 kilometers an hour when he drove away, which is still a little bit fast for a parking lot, but that was sort of the degree of diligence he was using in driving. And to me, one of the most objective pieces of evidence was that after he flees that scene, the police vehicle comes and sort of smashes into him to stop him. Another vehicle observed this and was so fearful that they drove through the gate trying to flee the police van that he was fleeing. So if you look at it objectively, it appears that his driving under the circumstances was acceptable only because I think the jury believed he rightly thought he was under attack.
Monty McGregor is a criminal lawyer. He's with us this half hour. We're talking about the acquittal yesterday by a Toronto jury of Umar Zamir, a 34-year-old who faced first-degree murder charges in the death of a Toronto police officer who had been struck and killed by Umar Zamir's car in an underground parking garage back in July of 2021. The whole case essentially hinged on whether it was a deliberate act or not, and it was found, the jury found, that it had not been, and therefore acquitted him. Interesting here, Monty, the judge saying at the end, I mean, the judge, we knew this from other articles afterwards, had been quite critical of the prosecution's case, but basically offered the accused, "You have my deepest apologies for what you've been through." That's not something we hear often from the bench.
No, it's very telling, and it's very, I think, insightful. And you have to remember, it's Justice Anne Malloy. This isn't some inexperienced rookie judge. She handled Manassian, and she was the trial judge on that. Mm-hmm. She's handled numerous high-profile cases and very difficult murders and homicides, and that's why I think she was given the task of administering this case. She seemed very displeased that the prosecution was focusing on a murder charge, especially when the eyewitness testimony was contradicted by objective evidence. It was a real question as to whether or not this should have just proceeded as a dangerous driving causing death, which would have been much more plausible, because you're putting Mr. Zamir's life on the line. You never know what a jury's going to do, and a judge will look at things in the appropriate legal analysis. And here, I think the apology that she extends to him is, you were charged and you've been put under the scrutiny of being demonized and looked at as a cop killer before all of the facts play out. And as they play out, it looks like you're clearly innocent here. And I think she felt that the case should have been administered differently given the nature of the actual evidence, because you have to remember, this matter would have had a preliminary inquiry. That's a hearing before the trial to, you know, test the evidence and see the sufficiency of the evidence and whether or not a prosecution is warranted. So the contradictions in the eyewitness testimony by the police officers, that would have been known by the prosecution in advance. The reconstructionist, that was known in advance of the trial, as well as the video surveillance. And I think now that the trial's over, the bail hearing decision has come out by Justice Jill Copeland, who's now at the Court of Appeal for Ontario, a very skilled and capable judge. They both had the same question. I say, why would this 30-year-old accountant with no criminal record that's new to get, why would he kill an officer?
And of course, you have to feel for Detective Constable Northrup's widow as well, who expected justice here. And there's that other side of a criminal case, right, where those who believe that justice will be served in this case didn't benefit from that either, because it, well, not necessarily because of the case, but it led to expectations, right? You know, the threat against Mr. Zamir of the prosecution and the expectation of the family of Detective Constable Northrup that there would be a prosecution here that would succeed.
Yeah. And, you know, I do a lot of murder trials. And sadly, when you end up going to the Superior Court of Justice to have a trial or to have a determination on something, that's like, anybody that's a victim of a crime usually doesn't get necessarily the justification they think they're going to receive from a criminal case. Because often when I'm doing a sentencing for somebody, I look at the family and say, I'm sorry you're here. Nothing is going to happen here that's going to emotionally put you back together. It might be a stepping point or a platform to leap off to try and have closure. But here, I agree, sadly, there's no winners in this situation. I mean, Mr. Zamir now is no longer the subject of the scrutiny of a criminal prosecution, and he's free to live his life. But you're right, Officer Northrup's family sit there every single day. They follow the case. They want to have some closure. They want to have someone be accountable. And in the end, I think it ends up being a very disappointing experience from the outset, especially if they had some expectations of legal accountability via somebody being convicted. Because clearly, from my view, as you looked at the evidence, it's like, this isn't going to happen.
Questions still to be asked or still to be answered, do you think, at this point? I mean, clearly there's the questions of the testimony given by Detective Constable Northrup's partners or his colleagues in this case. I think there are some others as well. What's left to be answered, do you think?
I mean, to me, I think some of the big lessons here are politicians weighed in on the bail release. That's unfortunate. Like, as a member of the criminal justice system, if you're not in it every day, one of the easiest things for the average layperson to do is misinterpret how it actually operates. My clients don't generally get bail, but there's this misnomer that gets presented, and then it gets amplified by, you know, people that are looked at to be the leaders of our society. And it was unfortunate that when the bail was granted, I think some politicians made some statements that didn't really gel with the reality of what's happened. And then you see that title change here from where he's villainized and demonized when he gets released on bail to now he's got so much support in the media and people are doing a GoFundMe page because his lawyers weren't paid enough to cover the case. That's one big lesson is, like, I think we need a better understanding of the justice system. As you said, the second big lesson is officers that testify, it's hard to lay blame on them because they have an inherent natural positioning that they're in, a bias that they're going to sit in. But all three officers seem to present the exact same completely contradicted story. So that's a concern. And then, of course, there's, you know, it's hard to look at police activity and sort of lay down these are the rules and the protocols when you're undercover and how you should engage in, because that's an inherently dangerous act. These officers are there on Canada Day to protect the public. Can we really be critical of their actions? It seems like they made some mistakes, but does this mean there should be a wholesale change? I don't know if that's the case. I know there's going to be an independent investigation on that front by, I believe, the Ontario Provincial Police to see if there's any way to better the system. But this was such a fast interaction, mere seconds, that led to a tragedy.
Monty, thank you so much.
It's so good to be here. Thank you for having me.
The Jewish community across Canada tonight is marking the beginning of Passover. It's a very important holiday. It celebrates, I mean, biblically, it celebrates the escape from Egypt, several thousand years ago. But it has always been a time to celebrate freedom and resilience. And this year, of course, it comes under very particular circumstances, not only the war in Gaza, but also the rise in anti-Semitism that we've seen, not just in Canada, but in other Western countries as well. It's certainly a cause for concern tonight, as well as the plight of the hostages who are still being held by Hamas as we speak. As you know, we spoke to the family of one of the hostages last week about this very same issue. Ottawa police today confirmed that their department is investigating a pro-Palestinian protest over the weekend on Parliament Hill. The police chief there, Eric Stubbs, says the investigation comes after receiving reports of a man at the protest praising last October's attacks by Hamas, according to a 40-second video circulated online. Eric Stubbs says it can be difficult for officers to see and hear everything that happens in a crowd, and that he himself has watched the video several times now.
And I had the luxury of, you know, being in my office where it's quiet, and I got to repeat it, you know, four or five times. And I'm not going to give you my opinions on that, but I certainly had to listen a number of times before I was able to clearly understand exactly what the person said.
Ottawa Police Chief Eric Stubbs there as they launched that investigation. Of course, there have been demonstrations right across the country for quite a while now calling for the end of the Israeli occupation of Palestinian territories, and that's taking place. There was one where I am on Saturday as well. Most of them peaceful, obviously. Some where the rhetoric has gotten beyond a certain line, clearly. We don't know exactly what's going to happen with this one, but one video posted online includes the voice of a man praising the attacks that killed 1,200 people on the 7th of October in Israel, and officers with the Forces Hate Crime Unit in Ottawa are looking into the matter. Have a listen to what was said, and I caveat here, this was what was said at the protest. This is what's under investigation, we believe, tonight. You be the judge.
When I say from the river to the sea, you reply with Palestine is almost free, because our resistance attacks are proof that we are almost free. October 7th is proof that we are almost free. Long live October 7th. Long live the resistance.
Yeah, I mean, certainly if you listen to that, the way that October 7th has been talked about, is praising it, is it not? Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, Conservative leader Pierre Poilievre, others have condemned the glorification of those attacks. A federal representative on combating Islamophobia has called the comments glorifying the October 7th attacks problematic. And this is going on as we are seeing other events unfolding in the U.S. U.S. President Joe Biden was asked today about the wave of anti-Israel protests across American university campuses and concerns about anti-Semitic violence during this week's Passover holiday. He was asked about the protests this afternoon as he left an Earth Day event in Virginia.
I condemn the anti-Semitic protests. That's why I've set up a program to deal with that. I also condemn those who don't understand what's going on with the Palestinians.
But as I mentioned earlier, this comes as Jews around the world begin to mark Passover, which began this evening. And of course, knowing that if we come back to Canada, that there has been a spike in acts of anti-Semitism since October and the October 7th attacks and the ensuing war in Gaza. Now, of course, it is Passover. So I spoke with Michael Levitt, president and CEO of the Friends of Simon Wiesenthal Center, a little earlier in the day because he was busy tonight with the Seder with his family. So we spoke a little earlier in the day, and I thanked him. I began, of course, by thanking him for his time.
Thank you for having me on again, Ben. Really appreciate it.
I mean, you know, we are at Passover, and this is a time to sort of celebrate freedom and so on. And just judging, I was following you on social media, and just noticed not that you haven't been concerned about many other events that have happened over the last 6+ months, but over the weekend, what happened in Ottawa seemed to really, really touch a raw nerve for you.
Well, thankfully for me and so many other Canadians who were aghast at what they saw on the streets of our nation's capital, a rally with really such hateful chants and sloganeering present, it was a shock. I mean, we've seen a lot in the aftermath of the October 7th terror attack by Hamas on Israel and Israelis. But who could have imagined on October 8th that the upshot all these months later of a day which was the largest death of Jews since the Holocaust would be the surging rise in anti-Semitism and really culminating on Saturday with a rally where there was open praise and glorification for that act of terror. And I quote, "October 7th proves we're almost free. Long live October 7th. Calls for intifada, calls for resistance by any and all means." I mean, this was something, it was the quiet part being said out loud, Ben. The quiet part being said out loud.
And this is, I mean, there has been condemnation. I've seen it from different politicians and so on. I believe Ottawa police today opened an investigation into this. Have you seen the reaction you would have liked to have seen?
You know, it's so hard to answer that question because it's in the immediate aftermath. So in the immediate aftermath, do I want to know that political and law enforcement leaders are taking this situation seriously, condemning it, and making it clear that this is not who we are as Canadians? This type of activity, this type of hate has no place on our streets. And, you know, again, you mentioned it. It's my understanding that Ottawa police have opened an investigation. I think there's going to be more from them. Yes, I'm pleased to see that. But the words only mean something if they're accompanied by action. And too many times post-October 7th, after rallies where other hate has been present, or after Jewish institutions, schools in Montreal targeted with bullets, businesses, Jewish-owned businesses in Toronto targeted with arson, a synagogue on just this past weekend in Toronto targeted by a masked individual with a hammer who broke multiple windows. In the aftermath of these incidents, we see our country's leaders being keyboard warriors. They're on there, they're tweeting, they're talking about standing with the community. But it's still happening. And we need to see those words turned into action. Action would be charges laid. Action would be the governments at all levels making it clear that they're going to be addressing this scourge of anti-Semitism in real and meaningful ways. So am I satisfied? No, because unfortunately I've seen the words all too often not backed up by those actions.
Yeah, I mean, you were in politics, you were an MP, Michael. What do you think is going on behind the scenes here? Because I think those of us who watch from afar, and of course, I'm in Victoria where things have been quite quiet, you know, thankfully for everybody involved. But to see the graffiti, to see it happen again and again and again, is so disheartening. I mean, regardless of what you think about what's going on in Gaza, the attacks on Canada's Jewish community has been so disheartening that the inability to separate, that Jewish institutions are being targeted because of what's happening overseas has been so incredibly disheartening. And I mean, I don't need to tell you this.
No, but you're right, Ben. And you know, you do need to tell me, because I have to tell you, it's so important to hear non-Jews, to hear allies of the Jewish community saying it out loud. So it actually means a lot when you say it. That understanding that you have, and the fact that you have a platform to be able to talk about it, which you've done. You know, you've mentioned having me on a number of times. I wish we were discussing hockey or something, but no, it is important. But what we're seeing is just a lack of clarity, a lack of moral clarity from politicians to be able to call these activities out. The less they do, the more acceptable it becomes on our streets, and the further the envelope is getting pushed. I understand that politicians have different constituencies, different personal beliefs. They're going to take different sides on an issue. And we all, let me say it, like from a humanitarian perspective, the plight of people in Gaza, the population in Gaza, those that have been impacted by this war, the population of Israelis, look at those living on either side of the border in Gaza, the people that were in those kibbutzim, the small villages where that ended up getting burned to the ground. The humanitarian toll continues to be so dire. We can all express that. And by the way, there's people at protests across the country that are doing that in a way that does not cross into hate, that they are, expressing themselves and talking about a situation that they absolutely legitimately have the right to. But when we see terror being cheered on, when we see hundreds of people marching, as we did in the videos from this past weekend, when we see them cheering repeating the messages, that is something very different. And it shouldn't take a great deal of courage for politicians of all stripes, on both sides of the aisle, provincially, municipally, you name it, to be able to call that out. And we've seen that oftentimes far too many are not willing to do so. And that's a concern.
Michael Levitt is president and CEO of the Friends of Simon Wiesenthal Center. He's a former MP as well, Liberal MP from Toronto. Michael, I mean, I suspect that, you know, you think back to last Passover a year ago and just how much the conversations will have changed this year and what those conversations will be about as families gather to talk, essentially, where all families gather during the holidays. I can't quite picture what those conversations might be like this year.
It's going to be a difficult conversation this year. And as you say, the Passover meal, the Passover Seder, is one that brings people together to retell the story of the Exodus from Egypt. And it's a story of resiliency. It's a story of, being the underdog, but persevering. And all those things ring true today. But I can tell you, at our Seder tonight, and I'm going to my in-laws for dinner, we are going to have an open chair. We're going to have an open chair with a poster on it of the hostages, 133 of them still being held by Hamas and other terror groups in Gaza. And that chair will sit open. And I can tell you that we're all going to be looking at that empty seat. We're going to be looking at it with great sadness, with great concern, with a sense of loss of the hostages that are still being held, but for the ones that we lost too, the families that were torn apart, as we talked about before, on that Gaza border on October 7th. And that will be a real focus for so many Jewish families tonight gathering. There's going to be that weight, that sense of loss, that is going to be defining for so many of us.
Indeed, yeah, we had the family of one family, extended family of one of the hostages on last week to talk about it as well, and how difficult tonight's going to be around the world. Obviously, yeah. Where do we go from here, Michael? Because it feels like, I mean, you know, as we all know in Canada, there's a legitimate right to protest. There is a legitimate right to disagree with how Israel is conducting the war in Gaza. This is probably not the right time to talk politics. There, all these things are legitimate. At the same time, we cannot condone hate, and we cannot have a community feel like it's under siege in this country. You know, I was in Paris shortly after the Charlie Hebdo attacks. And I remember talking to the Jewish community in France and feeling the insecurity, feeling like they weren't welcome in their own country anymore. And wouldn't, if that's where we're headed here, and we're, you know, we saw what's going on at Columbia University and so on, it feels like we need to nip this in the bud now.
That's right. And I said it earlier on Twitter, let this serve as a turning point. Again, the quiet part got said out loud on the weekend with that glorification and support of terror. And I don't believe that's a message that Canadians hold. I do not believe that's a message Canadians hold. And I think it's an opportunity for, as we've seen, people to be calling out that behavior, for police to absolutely go back and look and see what went on the streets, but to understand that things are getting worse. As a Jew in Canada, I've always held my head high. I've always worn my Canadian Jewishness as a badge of honor. This is a good place to raise my two kids and for us to be a family and, you know, for us to thrive. But people are looking at it very differently today. And I get phone calls from people all over the world asking me, like, what happened in Canada? Are you okay? Are you safe? And I am safe. And, you know, we're not going to be running away. I say that about myself, but I say it about the community writ large. We're not going anywhere. We're not running away. We're not going to hide and cower, but we expect our political leaders and we expect our leaders in law enforcement to keep us safe. We expect university and college deans and presidents to make sure that their campuses are a safe space for Jewish faculty and students. We expect that when we go to synagogue over the next couple of days for Passover or on Shabbat on Saturday mornings or whenever we go, that we are not going to be subjected to threats or violence or acts of vandalism. We expect that because the Jewish community has been such a part of Canada's fabric, and we know that Canadians of good conscience do not agree with or condone these acts that we're seeing on the streets, on campus, in our, you know, in our cities, in our provinces, in our country. And I would just say that there absolutely is ways to protest, ways to express concern and you know, to be able to raise the issue of what's happening in the Middle East. But Jews in Canada are not responsible for actions in the Middle East. And anti-Semitism is being brought to bear in all sorts of places. And that is not right. And it's something, as a country, we have to make clear will not be tolerated within our borders.
Michael, to you and yours and the whole team that you work with, happy Passover. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ben. And again, hopefully the next time we'll be able to have a lighter conversation. And I look forward to doing that with you sometime soon.
Let's go back to last Tuesday and talk a bit more about the federal budget, because one of the items that a lot of people were looking out for that actually wasn't really mentioned much was the unveiling of what the funding would look like, what the program would look like for the Canada Disability Benefit. Now, the government passed legislation last year called Bill C-22 to introduce the national benefit, which was meant to lift people out of poverty by topping up provincial support funding, right? Estimates are that there are as many as 1.6 million working-age people in Canada living with disabilities who are below the poverty line. And this was meant to help alleviate them, bring them out of poverty. So there was a lot of expectations about what this might look like. And of course, they've been advised and so on over time. There have been lots of negotiations going on about what this might look like. And this was a big deal. This was a big deal. So when it was announced, it fell, and we talked about this last week, it fell far short of expectations. Too little for too few. In the budget tabled last Tuesday, the government said its new disability benefit would pay about $2,400 a year. So you do the math, $200 a month, right? It's a $6.1 billion program, which sounds good until you realize that that's actually over 6 years. So it's $1 billion a year to impact approximately 600,000 Canadians. And that only starts in July of 2025. So it's delayed a year. It only covers about, you know, maybe half of those who need it, depends on the numbers that you know, 600,000 max. And it's really not that much money, $200 a month. It's not going to bring people out of poverty. So did they overpromise and undercommit? I mean, what's only palpable so far has been the disappointment. Michelle Hewitt is co-chair of Disability Without Poverty.
The aim of this bill, this legislation, was to lift disabled people out of poverty. $200 does not lift any disabled person out of poverty.
Indeed. There's been a lot of criticism about this. Michael Prince is amongst the critics. He was a member of the Federal Disability Advisory Group. He resigned in protest over this. He's been working on disability issues for decades now, and this was, he called it a colossal failure by the Trudeau government, and now he's resigned. He is a professor of social policy at the University of Victoria, someone I've interviewed in the past on other issues, not this one necessarily, but he joins me now. Michael, thank you.
My pleasure, Ben. Nice to talk to you again.
Indeed. I mean, I was, obviously I knew when you joined this group, I follow you on social media, so I remember when it was announced, and there was a lot of expectation, I think, that we were, you know, the government had clearly made, talked about this in the throne speech in 2020, if I remember back correctly.
That's right.
This was meant to be, you know, this was all systems go on this. What happened?
You're right. I mean, part of the disappointment, just to give your listeners an idea of the depth of the disappointment, Ben, is, in the throne speech in September 2020, the government finally announced it was committed to a Canada disability benefit. And one of the key things it said in that throne speech, because often, as you know, those are fluffy, vague words that can be tossed around in throne speeches. But this one was quite specific, saying we will introduce a program and it will be modeled along the lines of the guaranteed income supplement program, which is the income-tested supplement for low-income seniors in Canada, a program that's been around for 50 or 60 years, and has actually made a serious dent in reducing the poverty among senior citizens in this country. So when we heard that news in September 2020, that was inspiring, that was exciting. It helped disability groups begin to hope that finally something substantial was going to be done at the federal level to address poverty. And so, you know, a bill was developed in that parliament. Then it got first reading. Then there was a snap election call, and the bill died. And then we came back after that election and regrouped, and the bill was dusted off and reintroduced into parliament. And then last summer, as you say, it got passed. And in the final weeks of it being reviewed by both the House of Commons and the Senate, there were some key amendments made. I mean, it was a framework piece of legislation, just bare bones. But in the Senate, there were amendments made that then went back to the House, which were adopted, and it was passed unanimously by all political parties. And in those amendments included a couple of key things. One was to say this is when the benefit amount is established by the government, which is well within their prerogative, it must take into consideration the market basket measure or the official poverty line of Canada. Secondly, it must acknowledge and address the fact that people with disabilities have extraordinary additional costs out of pocket that other Canadians do not incur. And thirdly, to pay heed to the UN Convention on the Rights for Persons with Disabilities, an international treaty that all governments in Canada signed about 10 years ago. So those were kind of the reference points and the expectation. And with images of the guaranteed income supplement amount dancing in our heads, Ben, that, okay, this benefit probably then is going to be around $800, $900 a month, maybe $1,000 a month that would be on top of provincial social assistance. So you're right. Last Tuesday, you open up the budget. Oh, here it is. You look it up and it says $2,400 a year at max, $200 a month. And again, then just the shock. First, I thought it was a typo. I thought, oh, they must mean $24,000 a year on top of the benefits, and that'll be a real substantial. No, $2,400 for the year. That's the maximum that only some people will get. And as you said in the intro, up to maybe max 600,000 to people, depending on who qualifies. And that's leaving up to another 1 million Canadians in poverty. So that's stunning in itself. So as you said, too little, kind of late. It doesn't start till July 2025, just probably before a federal election next fall in 2025. But I wouldn't want to campaign on this if I was a Liberal MP. I mean, this has backfired, and this has caused a lot of disappointment and criticism. I think the government is kind of on its back heels on this one. They've just made a terrible political calculation and underestimated the depth of commitment to this for people and the real need. And I think the sympathy, which I appreciate, that's kind of been picked up by you and many others across the country who are paying attention to it in a way that perhaps a lot of people weren't following for the last several years.
Well, Michael, what surprised me about it more than anything, I think we could all agree that $200, I mean, every little bit helps, obviously, as people are wont to say, but that's just not enough money. I see the government's facing some fiscal issues that it probably didn't want to spend too much money on this at this point in time. At the same time, if you're gonna lay, sort of stake your claim on solving the affordability crisis, what about the million plus adult, working age adults with disabilities who can't make a living in an inflationary time? You'd think they would be first in line.
Absolutely. And in part, the government is trying to deflect onto blaming the provinces who, they're saying, well, you've chronically underfunded your provincial social assistance programs. And that might be somewhat true. I was on a call earlier today where the minister spoke before me, and she really laid into the provinces of being, the problem here. And I reminded the listeners, said, well, the federal government abandoned cost sharing of social assistance back in 1996. You might remember under the Jean Chrétien government, that Paul Martin cut out the Canada Assistance Plan, where the federal government up to then for generations had been cost sharing with the provinces the cost of welfare, the safety net. And, a lot of the people on those safety net programs are people with disabilities. So it's a little rich 25 years later for federal minister to say, well, the provinces have been very delinquent in paying for this and they should have been paying more. And, ours is a start. It's historic. And I'm thinking, well, it might be historic, but not for the reason that you think it is. It's historic in that it's a lost opportunity. And it's, a political miscalculation. And it'd be interesting to see how the opposition parties, Jagmeet Singh's already talking about it in terms of considering whether he'll support the budget or not. But, how will the Conservatives pick up on this? This might be a place where they actually could be seen as more compassionate, believe it or not, on a social policy issue than the Trudeau Liberals. So I think this has got some legs to it and some a dynamic that will be really interesting to see, Ben, how it plays out over the coming days and week.
Yeah, to be frank, when we were getting questions on our, from listeners, one of the ones that came up the most often was the disability benefit, right? People were waiting. People were waiting for this to see what this looked like. When expectations are raised, as you pointed out, Michael, what's your sense of what happened here? Because I think I could guess. Essentially, they didn't want to delay this announcement anymore because no announcement would have been worse, perhaps, than what they did on last Tuesday. At the same time, they were about to move a ton of money out the door on things like housing and so on, and there just wasn't much left in the coffers to pay for this. But it just feels like, is that your sense, that they simply didn't want to spend the money that they should on this program?
I think so. Who would have thought, in 2020, when this was first announced and with brave language, and the minister who ran with this bill the longest was Carla Qualtro, who then got shuffled out. And that might be part of it too, Ben, is you just have to wonder if she'd stayed in the portfolio. She was clearly the sponsor of the bill. She was the champion. She said some really strong statements about poverty reduction, both in the House of Commons and in the press. And, how she would have felt if she was at that cabinet table over the last few months and getting briefed on, well, this is actually what we're going to roll out, Carla. And, she would have had a real political problem there because she would have been the sitting minister who had said all these things. She's now shuffled off into amateur sport. But, I think she got shuffled out, and a much more junior minister with real no clout in the cabinet, given the file, it was clearly sliding down the priority lists, and then housing becomes the issue for this government. And fair enough, I will applaud them on the commitments and historic investments that we're making up. But we could say the same about disability, that we should have been putting more money into disability for the last 20 or 30 years, and we haven't, and we have a crisis of affordability and accessibility for this population. And so so the big amounts of money, you're right, all got rolled out before the actual budget day on housing and some other initiatives. What I also find interesting is, the Trudeau government's been accused of overreach by the premiers. You're now intruding, Mr. Trudeau, into some of our provincial jurisdictions, whether it's on health care or you're trying to flow money through municipalities and you really shouldn't. Those are our jurisdiction or climate action. But suddenly you look at the disability file and what's said about in the budget, Ben, and suddenly they get all careful about the jurisdiction. It's like, well, this is really primarily a provincial jurisdiction, and so our $200 is a nice first step.
Yeah.
Suddenly they rediscovered the division of powers, Ben, and it's like,
I know. We're talking about Canada Disability Benefit, or the Canada Disability Benefit. We got the details of it in last Tuesday's budget, and has been met with quite a bit of anger and consternation, actually, from disability advocates across the country, including my guest, Michael Prince, who's a professor at the University of Victoria, a longtime disability rights actor, professor, scholar, and activist. He was with an advisory group for years now, from 2020 until just recently, when he quit over what he called a fiasco, essentially, the announcement of this disability benefit. Michael, your decision to step down, I mean, I suppose listeners might want to know what the advisory committee did and what your role was in it, but it does send a message. A lot of people have been talking about this. Obviously, you've been in high demand, I've seen, over the last few days about this decision.
Yep. Just quickly, I mean, the group, as you say, we were founded in the spring of 2020, Ben, by the then Minister Carla Qualtro. We were originally called the COVID-19 Disability Advisory Group to the Minister, and she assembled about 12 of us from across the country. I was honored. I was one of the few people that didn't represent an organization of people with disabilities, but she brought together people who wanted to make sure that she was getting the best advice about what was going on and the lived experiences of individuals and families living with disability in Canada. And, particularly that first year, very anxious times about protective equipment and hospital visitations and what social services and needs are out there and the risk of social isolation by particularly people with disabilities. So that first year in particular was rapid and quick, but that was also when the CERB benefit rolled out and we started to hear about people getting $2,000 a month for financial support. And that contributed to some of the expectations I think we're seeing in response to this budget. But we continue to provide advice. And most recently, this past week, just before the budget, the group was presented with some information about employment strategies for Canadians with disabilities. So it continues to look at a range of issues. But after I read the budget last Tuesday, I sat down in front of my computer Tuesday night and just started to tap out my concerns and frustrations, maybe partly cathartic or therapeutic, but just to kind of put down my thoughts. As you'll know, I texted a few things on social media about it that night and really triggered a real response. I thought, okay, good, people are watching. And it just didn't sit well with me. And I thought about it on the Wednesday, and then I started to think about resigning. And the reason why was I thought, if I remain quiet about this, people might just assume that I'm supportive of this and I accept it, or that the advisory group was part of this. And I felt that as long as I remained on the group, I would be limited in what I could really express publicly or certainly by social media. So I then drafted the resignation letter and then, sent that to the minister. But I also then thought I need to make this public, because if I just send in a text to the minister, no one will know, and I'll get a polite letter in 3 or 4 months from an official thanking me for my service, and I will not have really made a contribution or helped raise awareness. So I quite deliberately stepped away and then made it public to the kind of raise awareness and contribute to the debate and let people know I wasn't happy. And I'm pleased with the, as you say, the media response the response just, my resignation letter, which I posted on my ex, formerly known as Twitter account, I think it's up to about 110,000 impressions now. So it's really, it's the most significant tweet or message I've ever done, Ben, in terms of take up. Others that I've done over the years, it's interesting. It's usually around veterans and benefits for disabled veterans. So it's clearly, there's clearly a following that certainly follows me on social media, and I've been quite, I'm not sure what the right word is, touched, and also...
Michael, I think someone was looking for someone who had knowledge of this, who wasn't from an advocacy group, because we can understand them, of course, no slight to them, but someone else within sort of that idea of the advisory group, and I think your photo's already gone from the website, that would stand up and say, listen, this isn't what we expected, and this isn't right. Can you fix it now? I mean, there's been many things that, you know, that... The number of people that it encompasses is too small. There are ways of applying for it that are a bit onerous. You actually have to reapply through another doctor. In other words, you know, we were talking about this last week that, you know, to benefit from this, you actually have to go back to the doctors, which seems ridiculous given the situation with the medical system right now. And it just applies to too few people. Plus, it goes through the disability tax credit, which you thought was a problem to begin with. So is this redeemable? Because they're talking about, you know, a big first step, and you're thinking, well, wait a second, you've been talking about this for 4 years. So,
anyway. It's not a big step. It was a big misstep, I would say. And yeah, I mean, some groups are, you know, an organization, a highly respected social policy, like the Maytree Foundation in Toronto, a very progressive social policy. They've done a review of the budget. They're very complimentary of a lot of it, including the housing initiative. But they say on this one, the government got it badly wrong and they need to address it immediately. So that's what some groups are hoping for. The Rick Hansen Foundation, I see they've said, again, a mistake. And like other groups, they're saying, well, we hope to see maybe a correction made in the fall economic statement. So some are, you know, pushing for, you know, admit you made an error, respond quickly. As you know, I mean, you're an old government watcher. This rarely happens where a government will change a budget at this stage. It is possible, but if they were, I would think maybe they would wait till when the House is not in session and they roll out something maybe in June quietly. But the next opportunity probably is Finance Minister Freeland's fall economic statement. Then the last, of course, would be the 2025 budget, maybe next spring, or, you know, and that would truly be the pre-election budget. So there are some opportunities which I think groups will press for. And I just, you know, you think back to this as history, but in 1985, the first Mulroney government budget, the finance minister was Michael Wilson. There was a measure in there about de-indexing old age security and the guaranteed income supplement. It was seen as an attack on low-income seniors. There was a great mobilization. All sorts of groups across the country condemned this new government with a large, you know, the largest majority in Canadian history at the time, as you know, by Brian Mulroney. Mm-hmm. And they blinked. And within 3 weeks, they changed the budget item. You know, so there you had a... Now, maybe you think, well, it was a new government, but a government with a huge majority. But Mr. Mulroney and Mr. Wilson said, yeah, we made a mistake, and they changed it within a matter of less than a month. So I hold out hope sometimes that maybe history can repeat itself like that, Ben. But
we'll see.
You know,
A lot of pressure. It is, I think part of the problem, and this is the cynicism of it, and this is what struck me last week, because even Chrystia Freeland barely mentioned it in the House of Commons, is that it's a voting thing. I mean, you don't de-index seniors' pensions because seniors vote, and you don't do that. You know, you target millennials and Gen Z because you think they're going to vote for us, right? Yeah, and I've always felt like when it came, and you know this better than I do, when it comes to the disability issue, people are ignored because the voting power isn't there the way you think it might be. That could be cynical on my part, but I'll put it to you.
No, I think that's always been the that's always been, I think, the conventional wisdom. And you know, one thing that's always interesting too is that you know, more and more we're trying to make voting more accessible in the country for people. There's a real hunger and desire by disabled citizens to vote. You contrast that with over the last 20, 30 years, the declining interest in voting turnout rate by the general population. So there's that, on the one hand, kind of a general malaise and alienation, on the other hand, you look at the disability community, it's quite the opposite. They want to vote, they're keen, there's this faith in democracy that's quite kind of refreshing. It might be naive, but it's inspiring. But you're right, they are not perceived as a major block or a cohesive vote. You know, the thing down the road, I mean, down many years from now, will be how this benefit, you know, the fact that it's low, and if it stays this low, this will become a federal election issue, no doubt about it. And the other parties will realize that this is a way both to hit the Liberal Party over the head over how this is a, you know, a mean-spirited or inadequate benefit, but also make their own promises. So I'm looking to see how, you know, once they let the genie out of the bottle, once this benefit actually gets up and running, And there will be the complaints about the onerous burden for eligibility, the inadequate benefit amount, and the doesn't cover large enough a population. Those are all real key things that could be in the platform of any shrewd federal political party to say, you know what, here's a constituency that we could speak to. This is a growing population. One in four Canadians now identify as having a disability. And now they're not all in poverty, but a large chunk of them are. So parties should wake up to the fact that this is a growing constituency and one that is deserving and one that requires some support. So I think this, you know, there's a political dynamic here that we can only just start to see how it might play out in the coming months, but also in the coming years, and certainly in the next federal election in the fall of 2025, Ben.
Michael, as always, thank you.
Yeah, my pleasure.
This is the challenge we need to meet, and our plan will meet this moment.
You always know when the Prime Minister is a little revved up, right? When he goes into election mode, when he talks like that. I don't know how to describe it, but it's that tone of voice. And that's the tone of voice he took when meeting with his caucus last Wednesday morning after the release of the budget on Tuesday. They're trying to sound as fired up as humanly possible, considering they've been sinking in the polls. And they're really hoping that this budget will help them somewhat, right? With the focus on affordability targeted at younger Canadians, basically, you know, references to millennials and Generation Z, Canadians under 45, really the heart of this. And apparently, according to the Globe and Mail this weekend, they are hoping this will be the beginning of, to end the listing of the ship Liberal, to bring it back to some sort of direction, to some sort of flotation, because they've been sinking in the polls, if you can excuse all the puns. They've been sinking in the polls for months and months and months now. So apparently, according to the Globe article, they want to start turning this around by 5 points every 6 months ahead of next fall's election, presumably. And that will allow them apparently to make up this deficit they now find themselves in. So a lot of spending promises and so on in this. And they're hoping to see a bit of a bump in the polls. Now, former federal cabinet, Liberal cabinet minister John Manley was on the West Block with Mercedes Stevenson over the weekend. And here's what he had to say about that.
And I've said this before, I subscribe to what I call the Seinfeld theory of political longevity, which is, you know, Seinfeld, great show, lasted 9 seasons. And if you think in terms of modern political history in Canada, think back, Brian Mulroney, 9 seasons. Jean Chrétien, 10 seasons. Stephen Harper, 9 seasons.
Yeah, you get the point, right? It's people get sick of watching the same show. Daryl Bricker is CEO of Ipsos Public Affairs, and he joins me now. Daryl, thank you.
Thanks for having me on, Ben.
The importance, we've both covered a lot of budgets over the years. They don't tend to be big shifters, right? They're not. People sort of pay attention to them, kind of. But this one feels like it's a mighty big deal for the Liberals right now. They've been sliding in the polls for a long time. And I feel like they feel like this is going to be, so they're either going to turn it around now or they're not going to turn it around.
Yeah, it's really been, I think, the last opportunity they had, unless they do something incredibly dramatic, like prorogue the House and have another speech from the throne, which would be very, very risky, given that they have to get one of the other parties to vote for them. But really, it was the last opportunity for Justin Trudeau and the Liberal Party to really communicate a message that would break through with Canadians and change their prospects for winning re-election, because the polls had been pretty universally dismal for them for almost a year. So they needed to get out of this trench that they found themselves in and see if they can get back into the sun again with their sunny ways and get Canadians re-inspired about voting for Justin Trudeau and the Liberals. So this is their big chance.
What did you make then of, I mean, we're going back nearly a week now, but I mean, obviously there was a big lead up to it. They gave away most of the, you know, they presented most of the gift. They unwrapped most of the gifts before the budget day, before the budget was even released. What did you make of the messaging in it? It seemed quite clearly targeted at two specific groups, and they must feel that's where they can still make up ground.
Yeah, I think people who do this for a living will be thinking about whether or not they did the right thing. I personally, I wonder if they did. In stringing it out over a week, I guess the idea that you can maybe get sustained coverage of what you're planning over a longer period of time, in theory, makes sense. But what they did give up was any need to focus on what actually was going to happen on budget day. And then the one piece that they did decide to put out on Budget Day that got the most attention appears to be pretty controversial, and that's the what they said about capital gains taxes. So I guess we'll be taking a look at that. In terms of the groups of people that they were focusing on, focusing mostly on homeowners or potential homeowners, and particularly young people, the new middle class and those who want to join it. And they were speaking very specifically to those groups of people. The question is, did they really break through with them?
Yeah. I mean, I know we're expecting a bunch of stuff from you, but in the short term, I suppose the real important part here, and you've pointed this out, because budgets are big, unruly, it's a 473-page document. Most people, I think most voters look at Budget Day and most reporters can barely make sense of the budget sometimes. I can't imagine what voters must be like. But in this sense, you were really looking for a couple of key questions, right? There were only a few things that you thought this budget could do to move the needle for the Liberals. And there were some really key questions that needed to be asked to determine that.
Right. Now, are you able to help people deal with the cost of living crisis that they feel that they're in right now? And there's a household aspect to that. And cost of living expenses, along with actually the cost of rent and maybe your mortgage. And then there was the other one, which is if you're a younger Canadian, do you feel that the best days are of the country behind us, and that the promise that you felt as part of your Canadian citizenship that you would be able to succeed beyond what the previous generation succeeded, would you still be able to do that? And a big part of that, again, is the question of home ownership. So did the government break through on that? And so far, I haven't seen a resounding groundswell of people saying that they're really satisfied with what they've heard.
Yeah, I mean, it takes some time, obviously, for these things to bake in. And one presumes that, first of all, I think releasing all the budget goodies beforehand was a way of getting off the carbon tax for a bit, which has been a real, real tough one for this government. But also, in a sense, it might take a little bit of time to see any kind of needle move. But then again, normally if something's going to, it would be trending in the right direction, I guess. You want to see something, if you're them, you want to see something moving the other way. And I don't gather that's what we're seeing just yet.
Yeah, in my experience of budgets, if they're going to really break through, they tend to break through quickly.
Right.
I mean, you have all of the media's attention right then. To the extent that people watch budgets, you have all of their attention right then. And if you don't break through with them, then later on, when the level of coverage intensity is less, even if you've got ministers out there trying to sell it, you're selling it to a pretty elite crowd, usually like local chambers of commerce and people like that. So is it going to break through with the average voter? Probably not. And when you're trailing by just under 20%, breaking through at the local chamber of commerce isn't going to quite do it for you.
Yeah. And I guess in this one, really what they needed to see is not a resounding applause, but some applause for them trying to tackle this affordability issue, perhaps very late in the game, but still they needed to see, especially since, forget the budget, they've been talking about these measures for a better part of a month before the budget day itself. You'd want to see that start to move on, how much can you trust this government with the economy? How much are they on your side when it comes to affordability? And if you don't see those numbers move at all, then I think the Liberals are in deep, deep trouble if they weren't already.
Right. And that's what we're going to be watching, over the space of the next few weeks. But this is a situation in which the players are really well known. The policies themselves, you could even think that some of the things that the government was proposing, and many people, I suspect, would think that many of the things that the government was proposing and their intentions were good. The problem that this government has run into, though, is it's this government that's making those promises. And it's this political leader who, by the way, completely personifies the entire Liberal administration. There is really nothing outside of the shadow of him. And that's the prime minister. Do you believe that this person who's making these promises is, even if well-intended, able to deliver what's being promised? And that's where this government runs into trouble because, they've had nearly a decade to demonstrate that they could deal with these issues and people are still concerned about them.
Daryl Bricker is CEO of Ipsos Public Affairs. We're talking this half hour about the Liberal budget that was released last Tuesday. They've been talking about it for weeks before then, and whether or not it's moved anything for them, because they've been going in the wrong direction in the polls for ages now. And I think the put a lot into this budget to see if they couldn't start to turn that around. In fact, an article in the Globe and Mail this weekend suggested that they really want to start to see this moving the other way. And according to Daryl, it hasn't quite yet. We'll get more info on that over the course of the week. But Daryl, you pointed out over the weekend in a series of social media posts that the real issue here, and you were just talking about it, is that, you know, in a change election, and Stephen Harper found this out back in 2015, and I think Rishi Sunak's about to find this out in the UK, when people want change, it's very hard for you to convince them that anything that you propose doing is going to move them off that desire to what they don't want you to be better. They just want you out of there. And that's a big challenge for any government.
Yeah. And that's what the Liberals are currently facing. I mean, they're tying for a change number. So we ask a question on our surveys. Do you think the government deserves to be reelected, or it's a time for a change and somebody else should be running the administration? Their time for a change numbers are in the 70s.
Wow.
Which is as bad as it gets. I mean, there were in that range before Stephen Harper started in the election campaign back in 2015. So that's, you know, we've come full circle. Justin Trudeau is now in the position that Stephen Harper was back in 2015, and we know how that turned out.
Indeed. And you pointed out something interesting too, that it's there hasn't been a full on, because people sometimes look at Pierre Poilievre as more as a sort of polarizing figure in his own right. This hasn't been this sort of wide scale embrace of him, but in some senses he's sort of presented himself as someone who can carry the ball here. And that for a lot of Canadians is enough. And also the NDP have kind of moved themselves out of that change equation by actually sort of, technically, you know, this confidence in supply, but being sort of identified as being part of the government.
Yeah, the NDP did half of the Pierre Poilievre's job by saying we're going to be the tail on this dog, and it's very difficult to separate themselves now because they've been so implicated in everything that the government's done. And, you know, the NDP can maybe take some solace or maybe even some pride in some of the things that they believe that they forced the government to do. But from an electoral perspective, it's done them no favors. Because normally, Ben, what happens is when the Liberals go down, the NDP goes up, but both of them have been going down. And they're losing support. Both parties are losing supporters to the Conservatives. So, and it's not because these supporters have fallen in love with the Conservative message, although some of them maybe have fallen in love with the Conservative message. It's just that what we're now into a situation is, the situation is status quo versus change. It's not whether you're a Liberal, Conservative, or an NDPer. It's not a partisan thing. It's not even an ideological thing. It's, are you for the status quo or do you want change? And there's only one party on the ballot outside of the province of Quebec that clearly represents change in the minds of voters right now. And the Tories have done a brilliant job. The Conservatives have done a brilliant job of positioning themselves uniquely on the change question. So they're in as strong a position as anybody could be right now because of that.
It's been interesting to watch, and it's not everywhere, but it's interesting to watch. Joe Biden's been having his troubles in the U.S. Emmanuel Macron is not popular. Rishi Sunak, obviously the Conservative Party, have been in power for ages in the U.K. But, you know, a lot of incumbents are finding themselves in similar positions right now. We've already seen some incumbents go. This is a tough time. People are pretty upset with their elected officials, right? Or at least the parties that are in power.
Yeah, well, we came out of the pandemic and a lot of politicians benefited from that. But people, the expectation was we were going to, and we heard this repeatedly, that we were going to have, you know, kind of the new roaring 20s. Well, it's been a gasping 20s. And what we've seen globally is that the COVID crisis has been replaced by the cost of living crisis. The two lines crossed almost 2 years ago and inflation has not come down. And this is a pretty universal situation. And if you've got people in a situation in which they are, you know, looking, you know, day to day as to whether or not they're going to be able to get by, and they're very worried about whether they're not going to be able to buy groceries, they're very worried about whether or not they're going to be able to afford to live in the homes that they have, it's no wonder that they're in the position that they're in. So what we're seeing is this huge desire for change all over the world. Now, sometimes it actually can't get manifested because of the political options that are there. But, you know, we got a big election coming up in India. Mm-hmm. I expect that there's a desire for change there, although the Modi government is very likely to win again, but probably not by as much as it won before. I think that you're going to see we've got some of the most interesting elections coming up in early June are going to be the European parliamentary elections. I think we're going to see the rise of the right and a rejection of some of the more progressive types of policies that have really become entrenched in the European Commission, in the European Union, are going to be rejected by a growing conservative coalition in Europe. We've got, as you mentioned before, the U.S. presidential election. Who knows how that's is going to turn out? But at the moment, it's far closer than anybody would have predicted. Particularly going back to what a fiasco we went through, in June of right after the previous election, or January just after the previous election, when there was a claim that there was an insurrection that that took place at the Capitol Hill in the United States. So it is a very fraught time, and change is in the air. And this is one of the things that's now confronting the Trudeau government.
Darrell, as always, thank you.
My pleasure.
I love these stories, and I particularly love this story because of the context around it. So there's a daughter and father in England, in Somerset, who are fossil hunters. And you know, they go out together, they look for fossils. The daughter's name is Ruby Reynolds. And a while back, I guess in 2020, she and dad were out hunting around. And would you know, they come across this fossil that is basically uncovers a new species of a long extinct and incredibly large marine reptile. I mean, the image of this thing, it's hard to describe. It looks a bit like a dolphin meets something very scaly and very large. Sort of. And that's not a great description. But it's a bit like a dolphin meets a Komodo dragon, if you can imagine. Which, again, is not quite fair, but it is massive. This thing is massive. A new giant sea reptile species that could have been over 25 meters in length. Like that's, you know, a couple, that's 2.5, 3 school buses, right? That's long. So in May of 2020, when Ruby was just 11, she and her father, Justin Reynolds, found the first pieces of the sea reptile's jawbone on a beach called Blue Anchor in Somerset in the UK. It was the fossilized remains of a second gigantic jawbone measuring over 2 meters long that was later found. And so they put this all together, and it's like an old jigsaw puzzle, according to researchers. Reuters did a report on this. Here's a bit of it.
Oh, that's just an exceptional find.
This jawbone fossil found by a British father-daughter duo belonged to perhaps the largest known marine reptile on Earth, dating back to around 202 million years ago. Ruby and Justin Reynolds found the bone in May 2020 on a beach in Somerset, England. They contacted paleontologist Dean Lomax, who said 4 years before their discovery, fossil hunter Paul de La Salle found a similar bone just down the coast.
We described Paul's bone in 2018 in a study as an unusual giant jawbone, Parvus serangula, from right at the back of the jaw of an ichthyosaur.
Researchers said on Wednesday the Reynolds bone is also from an ichthyosaur. The discovery of a second jawbone confirms the existence of a new species not previously known.
Based on that unique shape, various different structures, the fact that they're both right from the end of the Triassic period, about 202 million years ago, supports our identification of something entirely new to science, which we've named as a new species called Ichthyotitan severnensis.
There you have it, Ichthyotitan severnensis. This thing was massive. So massive that this jawbone itself is about 2 meters long. Jimmy Waldron is founder of Dinosaurs Will Always Be Awesome, although this isn't quite a dinosaur. And he joins me now from Orlando. Jimmy, thank you.
Ben, it's an absolute pleasure to be here with you and your audience. Hope you're having a great day so far.
This is, I mean, I always love these things because it's a reminder of sort of a world that we don't know much about, or at least we don't think much about. But tell me a bit about this fossil discovery, because it's not new, and yet we've had some breakthroughs because of it.
Well, it's an incredible discovery that we've made here, because with paleontology, nothing is new. You know, the earliest thing is about 10,000 years
true
old.
True enough. Yeah.
But in this particular discovery, this is so revolutionary because it changes a number of things that we know about early life on this planet. So the animal that we uncovered is called Ichthyotitan severnensis. And based on the measurements that we found of this particular jawbone and this incredible piece, this may very well be the largest creature that ever swam the oceans. And the estimates of how long it is actually places it larger than the northern hemisphere blue whale. So it's an incredible creature for sure.
I mean, how big are we talking here? Because that's big. That's I mean, we often use, I don't know why we always use school buses to do this, but I guess everyone kind of knows what a school bus looks like. And they're pretty uniform, regardless of where you go. So this is about kind of three school bus length, more or less.
Thereabout, yeah. So this creature is 25 meters in length.
Wow.
And the fact that we were able to come up with that estimation based on a piece of a small piece of its lower jaw is absolutely incredible. It's a testament to how well this science actually is built into its own fundamentals. It's really wonderful to find it.
So take me back to Ruby Reynolds, because I guess she's the one at the center of all this. And it's always so cool when sort of, a teen finds something, you know, kind of that changes things. So she found this, she lives in Britain, and this is where it was found. And the name sort of works into that as well.
Yes, it does. So Ruby is, I always love these stories when we encourage young girls and people to get into the natural sciences, because it's traditionally something that women haven't really been invited to. But if you go back 200 years, the story of a young girl going to dig on the beach and finding an ichthyosaur, we were talking about Mary Anning. And now we're talking about Ruby Reynolds. So she was with her dad and she said, I'd like to go fossil hunting today. And her dad, Justin, said, all right, let's go. So they went down to the shores there in Bristol in a place called Somerset. And as they're walking along the beach, they find this huge chunk of something that is clearly not a rock. You know, it's definitely something unique. It's like, this is a big bone. And so they did one of the best things you can do is you take pictures of all the sides, take a video of everything, and then you call a scientist and say, what am I looking at?
Right.
But so when... You know, one of our team members, Paul De La Salle, and then Dr. Dean Lomax, who is the lead author on the paper, came out to take a look at the specimen, actually pick it up and hold it and say, wow, this is really something very special, because it was very similar to a set of bones that Dr. Lomax had studied back in 2016 and 2018. And we found these bones and knew that they were something unique. It was definitely a kind of a giant ichthyosaur. And ichthyosaurs, by the way, Ben, are these huge reptilian creatures that live in the ocean. Think of the shape of a dolphin with a long, pronounced jaw, four flapping paddles to get it through the ocean, covered in scales because it's a reptile.
So like a giant alligator meets a giant dolphin meets, you wouldn't want to, I mean, I know this is always a bit ridiculous and it comes from watching too many of these movies, but it sounds like you mightn't want to bump into one anyway.
Oh, absolutely not. It's so big, it might chew you once or twice just out of a common courtesy. but its name, Ichthyotitan, literally translates to the giant fish lizard from the Severn River. So it's this group of animals, these ichthyosaurs, have always been considered, well, it looks like a reptile, but it also looks like a fish. So we're going to call it a fish lizard and make things totally uncomplicated.
It's funny how often I mean, not that I pay rapt attention, I'm not a paleontologist, but I've seen enough Jurassic Parks and I do interviews like this quite often, how little we talk about sort of the aquatic side of dinosaur life, if I can call it, the non-scientific way of putting it.
Of course. And actually, that's an important point to bring up here, Ben, because this Ichthyotitan creature lived alongside the dinosaurs. It lived at the end of the Triassic period, which was the first chapter of dinosaur life on our planet. But it was not actually a dinosaur itself.
Right.
Because it has its reptilian features, and so the paddles going off to the side and spending its life in the water, you know, those are actually reptilian traits, and dinosaurs walked on land with their legs straight beneath them and either covered with scales or feathers. You have to do all those things at the same time in order to be considered a dinosaur. So that puts this in a group with other things like mosasaurs and plesiosaurs and a lot of wonderful things that we actually find a lot in Canada too.
Interesting. I mean, that's the other thing about them. And I guess we'll talk about this creature in a second. But I suppose this is, what have you learned then from being able to, with this discovery by Ruby Reynolds, which is, again, I think she was 11 when she found it. Let's go fossil hunting, she says, and comes up with this. I love those stories.
Yes. No. So she was 11 years old. She went down to the beach and they found a few pieces of things that were very bizarre looking. The first big chunk looked like someone else had actually picked it up and put it down. Like, this is too heavy to carry to the car. We're going to leave it right here.
Right. How big are we talking? I mean, that sounds pretty large.
So this particular piece that started the whole process here is about a half a meter long in itself.
That is big.
And so it's a huge component. But then when she called for Dr. Dean Lomax and for Paul, they were able to go back out to the same site where they found it and look around for a few more pieces. And we were able to put together an at least 2 meter long section of just this one little bone. And this bone is called a serangular. And a serangular is an attachment point. It's a muscle attachment point at the top of the back of the lower jaw. And so it's a place where animals get a lot of the strength for their biting. I like to compare these to, a lot of dinosaurs and things people know about. So if you think about Tyrannosaurus rex, for example, T-Rex has one of the strongest bite forces in the known animal kingdom. And its serangular is about 600 centimeters long. It's 60 centimeters long. It's about a little more than half a meter.
Right.
Serangular on this creature is over 2 meters long.
Wow, so that's quite the bite. That's quite the
bite. It's an incredible. And as soon as we could find more of it, because we know there's more Ichthyotitan out there, so that's going to help us to continue developing our understanding of this creature.
Jimmy Waldron is founder of Dinosaurs Will Always Be Awesome. He's in Orlando, Florida. We're talking about work that his team has done on something called Ichthyotitan severinensis. It's this giant, just massive, bigger than a blue whale, perhaps, reptile that lived in the waters, well, I suppose, just about everywhere 90 million years ago. We'll talk about where it lived and how it lived. And it went extinct, by the way, obviously. But Jimmy, this is a really fascinating creature. So, obviously the world was a very different looking place back when it was about, but it lived in what is now modern day England, right? At least that's where this fossil was found.
First off, Ben, I got to give you points because Ichthyotitan severinensis is not an easy name and it rolled right off the tongue for you.
I get paid to do this. It's a great name. It's a great name.
So Ichthyotitan lived about 202 million years ago.
Wow.
It lived at the end of the Triassic period. So the end of the first third of the dinosaurs' reign, and the area that it lived was actually, Earth was going through so many changes at that time. It was right up against one of the major mass extinctions in our planet's history. This was at the time of what we call the Triassic and Jurassic extinction event. And what really spurred this on is that we started to form, for the very first time, the Atlantic Ocean.
Right.
Gotcha. So while this animal was swimming in the oceans, the land was still what we know as Pangaea, where all the continents were fused together.
Right.
So around this time, we started forming something called the CAMP, the C-A-M-P. That stands for the Central Atlantic Magmatic Province. And this is basically when a huge rift started forming right through the center of the land and driving those continents further and further apart. Kicking up all those, the CO2 and all the different greenhouse gases from deep within the earth changed the surface climate. And that led to massive amounts of ocean acidification because all those CO2 and all those different gases went up into the surface and into the atmosphere and came back down into the ocean. And that changed not only the temperature of our waters, but also the conditions. And it made even massive creatures like Ichthyotitan and Shonisaurus and other creatures here, it made the environment too volatile for them to live. And so these giant ichthyosaurs went extinct right as the dinosaurs were beginning to adapt and to become some of the more grand creatures that we know them.
Interesting. And so I suppose given that, you might be able to find fossils in many places. Obviously this one was found in Somerset, but this could be your search area could be quite large.
What's beautiful about this is that we find giant ichthyosaurs in several different places around the world.
Right.
And so we have found them in Nevada. We have found them in Australia. We have found them in California. We've even found some really wonderful ones in British Columbia.
Really? And so okay. There you go.
Oh, there's a fantastic specimen that is on display at the Royal Tyrrell Museum in Drumheller in Alberta. And it's one of the largest marine reptiles that you can possibly see in the world, found by Dr. Michelle Nichols. And it's an incredible creature to go and see. And so if you want to get a sense of what Ichthyotitan looks like altogether, you take a look at the wonderful Shonisaurus they have there, and you just go a little bit bigger.
Oh, wow. And are there, does it have anything even resembling a living relative? Even way down the list, I guess, who knows? You would know.
So we think about this question a lot when we are asked about creatures like mosasaurs, the big villainous creature from the latest Jurassic World movies. And the marine reptiles, as they are, yes, they're all pretty much extinct, but their closest living relatives are creatures like the Komodo dragon.
Right.
And even iguanas. So you look at those long skulls and those long jaws and the vicious teeth that they have in there. you know, reptiles, turtles, sharks, snakes, all these creatures were there. They remember when dinosaurs showed up to the party and they bid them bon farewell at the end. So, so many different kinds of creatures that lived on our planet have endured all these different kinds of extinction events. The ichthyosaurs sadly did not survive, but their closest relatives live on today in some of our giant reptiles and lizards that are out there.
How fascinating. What next then? What next? I mean, I guess there's the work never quite ends, right? There's always more to figure out.
It does not. No, we're very excited for what we have here now. The paper is now released. It's available in open access, so everyone can go and read all about it. You can see all the steps, all the processes that we've gone through. You can learn about the way we drilled and did a core sample of this specimen to find out that our gigantic ichthyotitan is still a growing baby.
Oh, really? It wasn't a full-fledged, it wasn't there yet. Wow.
25 meters long and still room to grow. It's incredible to find more about what this creature actually is. And we're looking to get back out into the field, into the locations where these were found, because we have some excellent jaw material so far, but people always want to know what else is there. What more secrets and uncovered mysteries can we find by digging a little bit deeper into the birds?
Well, Jimmy, fascinating stuff. Thank you so much.
Ben, absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for having me today.
Great to have you here on this Monday night. Over the weekend, this was anticipated, by the way, on Friday evening. We kind of knew this was coming because it had taken so long. The U.S. House of Representatives on Saturday approved a $95 billion U.S. package that will provide military aid to Ukraine and Israel, replenish U.S. weapon systems, and give humanitarian assistance to civilians in Gaza.
On this vote, the yeas are 366 and the nays are 58. The bill is passed.
366 to 58. So it wasn't even close, right? And, you know, a lot of this had to do with certain House Republicans, the so-called Freedom Caucus, Marjorie Taylor Greene, you may know that name, that it sort of stood in its way. And for a while, Donald Trump also made it quite clear that he didn't want to see a win for the Biden administration on this file. The bill now moves to the Senate, where passage is expected to happen soon, probably by Wednesday, I think, with close to $61 billion slated just for Ukraine and U.S. weapons stockpiles. Top lawmakers on national security committees have gotten pretty concerned about the situation in Ukraine because Russia's been on the front foot a bit in the last several months, and they've been attacking certain Ukrainian places, especially a city called Kharkiv that we've talked about often in the past. It is Ukraine's second largest city in the Far East, right near the Russian border. And the Ukrainian military has been talking about a shortage of troops and ammunition and so on. Here's Republican House Leader Mike Johnson after the vote on Saturday.
I said these are not normal times. They're not. The world is destabilized, and it's a tinderbox. It's a dangerous time. Three of our primary adversaries, Russia and Iran and China, are working together, and they're being aggressors around the globe. And they're a global threat to our prosperity and our security. Their advance threatens the free world, and it demands American leadership. If we turn our backs right now, the consequences could be devastating.
House Leader Mike Johnson, the Republican House Leader Mike Johnson. And for a while, it didn't look like this was going to happen. It has been delayed for months now. Again, the approval of this long-delayed U.S. military aid to Ukraine is precipitating a race against time to dispatch weapons to Kyiv, because, again, Russia has been taking this time to sort of get back on the front foot. It's raising some pretty tough questions about whether it will be enough to turn the tide. Here's Ukrainian MP Oleksiy Goncharenko speaking to Global News yesterday.
That's very good that this decision is finally made. But I should tell you that with this package, we're winning the time. We're not winning the war. It's not something which will have a final and decisive impact.
Indeed. So this is more about buying time than anything else. But what kind of impact has this had? Can we expect more aid from the U.S. to Ukraine in the future? Or is this a one-off? I thought we'd ask former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, John Herbst, who's now the senior director at the Eurasia Center with the Atlantic Council. He joins me now. John, thank you.
My pleasure.
Well, this was a long time coming. I mean, we talked about this off and on, about the sheer impact of this aid or the lack of it to Ukraine. Just your reaction to what finally got passed by the House of Representatives on Saturday.
Well, I'm not going to tell you I expected it to happen this month, but I expected it to happen, say, by the end of May. It's been clear to me since at least, say, November that Johnson was in favor of the aid, but not in favor of losing his job. And that since then, he was seeking some way to get the aid done and to keep the speakership. And while I was skeptical that he could achieve that, today I think it's probably in the process of happening. There is, you know, there are now three members of the Republican caucus in the House who are trying to remove him, but that's not the eight that got rid of Speaker McCarthy. Mm-hmm. And while they're sounding a little bit louder today, it's pretty clear they've lost not just the debate over the debate over aid. I think they're in the process of losing their influence.
Which is interesting because for people outside of the U.S. who sort of scratch their heads at this idea that Ukraine aid all of a sudden became caught up in all kinds of other issues, the holdup really was sort of this relatively small group of people within the Republican Party, and obviously the influence of the former president as well on this. But it really was successful in blocking this for quite a while.
That's correct. Although I think that there's insufficient attention paid to the nuance of the former president's position. Mm-hmm. Many analysts, I think, almost robotically identify Trump with his loudest supporters in the House, who include the naives who don't understand how critical defeating Putin in Ukraine is to American interest. I'm talking about Marjorie Taylor Greene.
Indeed,
I'm talking about Matt Gaetz. I'm talking about Thomas Massie. And on the Senate side, it's Vance, Senators Vance and Lee. But point of fact, Trump has never spoken out against the aid package, whereas all of them have spoken out vociferously and without, intellectual distinction to the aid package. And while everyone noticed that Johnson went to Mar-a-Lago the week before last, mm-hmm. and had a kind of friendly meeting with Trump, no one drew any conclusions from it. And the same folks, both in the analytical community, in the mainstream media, and in the Democratic Party, and in the MAGA community on the Republican side, have not given due attention to Trump's very interesting statement last week that the survival of Ukraine is very important, is important to the United States. All those suggest a fair amount of distance between Trump and, again, his loudest supporters in Congress.
Right, and his ability to sort of move around depending on what's going on the ground. How badly, I mean, what has the impact been on Ukraine with the delay in this aid?
There's no question that the six-month delay has been hard on Ukraine. It's led to more casualties, the loss of more territory. It's also been a disaster for American leadership. We look unreliable. And this can be blamed, you know, pretty much on the MAGA Republicans.
And in that sense, I mean, I guess the reaction from Ukraine was a sense of what we got, what I understood watching President Zelensky yesterday and so on, was a sense of relief, right? A sense of that perhaps not all is lost here, because you do get the sense from them that they feel this has had a real impact on their ability to wage this war.
Look, I've been in Ukraine twice in the last 7 weeks.
Right.
And so I've seen up close and personal the impact that it's had. And again, it's led to more deaths. It's led to the loss of territory. It's led to this truly devastating attack, or rather the impact of the Russian attack on energy facilities and other civilian infrastructure. There's no doubt about that. But it's also true that there's been another problem with American policy, and this has to go straight to the administration. The administration has been timid in sending Ukraine the military equipment it needs because they've been spooked by constant nuclear threats from Moscow. Mm-hmm. A very bad look for a superpower like the United States.
Indeed, at a time when an ally is basically fighting this fight. What is the sense you get then that with this money now freed? I mean, it's not quite there yet. But is there a sense of optimism in Ukraine that this may allow them to fend off what feels like go ahead.
I have no doubt, and I believe, I know this feeling is shared in Ukraine, that with this support, we will probably see the end to any real Russian gains. Not that they've had great gains over the past several months, but the incremental gains they've gotten are just about to end. And if, in fact, we were simply to continue our support for Ukraine the way we've done it without delay, of course, over the past 2 years, there's no way Putin could win. But we have not committed to the fight to ensure that Ukraine wins. And again, that's that you can't blame on the Freedom Caucus in the House. That you can point to the administration, which again has been overduly spooked by Putin's nuclear threats.
I mean, Ambassador Herbst, you were there. Yeah, I've spoken to our former Canadian ambassador to Ukraine as well. I think everyone there understands the nuances of those threats quite well. And I've heard many different opinions on this, but how is it that, I mean, it seems odd now that this war has been going on for more than nearly 2.5 years now, that there was this idea that somehow a Russian defeat would be a terrible thing, or that somehow Russia couldn't allow Russia to be humiliated here, quote unquote.
Again, this was very bad and old-fashioned thinking, which we've only gradually gotten rid of, but not entirely. Of course, when you're in a confrontation with a nuclear superpower, which Russia is, you have to be very cautious about the nuclear element. But in fact, we have had a lot of experience with such confrontations during the Berlin crisis, twice in 58 and 61, the Cuban Missile Crisis in 62. And never did American officials say publicly, as they have in this crisis, that we cannot do X or Y or Z, principally in terms of supporting Ukraine, because the Russians might go nuclear. That's a demonstration of weakness. And if Putin were to win in Ukraine because we did not give Ukraine what it needs, you can be sure he'll provoke a crisis over the Baltic states, over Poland, and he'll use the same tactics. And we'll find ourselves in exactly the same situation, in a far less advantageous to us position.
Have you had a sense of where that timidness is coming from?
Congressman McCaul, the chairman of the House Foreign Relations Committee, pinned this on National Security Advisor Sullivan. Others have looked at the president for this. I can't be certain as to who precisely is responsible. But, Harry Truman famously said the buck stops here, meaning in the Oval Office. Right. So ultimately, this rests on the president. This is the policy of his administration.
John Herbst is the former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine. He's now the senior director at the Eurasia Center with the Atlantic Council. We're talking about U.S. aid to Ukraine flowing or should be flowing soon. Once again, it had been several tens of billions of dollars have been blocked up for months as it got fought out in Congress. Ambassador Herbst, when you look at what the future now holds, I mean, clearly, a predictable source of funding from the U.S. is what Kyiv wants. But there are a lot of politics still out there, although you mentioned, of course, earlier that the former president, Donald Trump, seems to have moderated or at least clarified a position that seems a bit more favorable to Kyiv than he had in the past.
There's no question about that. That does not therefore mean that if he were to win the presidency in November, that he would continue to provide substantial aid to Ukraine. But nor does it mean, as many people seem to assume, that if he wins, he cuts off the aid pipeline. We just don't know. I think that, now, of course, it doesn't really matter what I think. It depends on what Trump and his team thinks. I think it is politically advantageous for him to make it clear that he is okay with this. And if he were to start criticizing the administration for being weak, the way, say, Ronald Reagan would, that would probably enhance his electoral fortunes. I would hope that Biden and his team understand this danger. And the timidity that has characterized their policy to date will, go away quickly. I hope that's true. I don't know if it's true.
In terms of what we saw, and you mentioned it off the top, that the Freedom Caucus, quote unquote, within Congress, that had sort of managed to hold up this aid for a while. This seemed like a big defeat for them, especially if there are no repercussions for the Speaker of the House. And it feels like perhaps at least that aspect of the aid fight may have come to an end, at least for now.
There's no question it's a defeat for them. They've made it clear. The fact that one more congressman has joined the coalition to get rid of him, now there are three, there used to be two, suggests that this sentiment is growing in amidst their very small, small ranks. It doesn't mean they're going to have any success. And my sense is that they've not just lost this battle, but they're starting to lose the public relations battle. Some of the hardliners in that group are referring to Speaker Johnson as a rhino, a Republican in name only. Mm-hmm. And they say, well, look, Democrats in the House are supporting Johnson. What those hardliners are not pointing out, that they were joined by the squad, the most left of left Democrats, in voting against the Ukraine aid package. Mm-hmm. And that reflects the naivete or the ignorance of both the extreme left and the extreme right when it comes to threats to the United States. They are partners in that naivete.
What is your sense then? Because here we are. I mean, again, one of the assumptions always when this war began is that the clock was ticking to some extent, especially I think the Ukrainians, and you've been there twice in the last 7 months, that will tell you this, that they're fully aware of the fact that things happen, other things happen, and people stop paying attention to something like the war in Ukraine. As far as you're concerned, within the U.S. right now, what is your sense of support for Ukraine right now in this fight against Vladimir Putin?
Support is still a large majority, 60 or so percent. There was a poll put out last week. I referenced it in an article that I wrote with Deborah Kagan in the New York Post. I think it appeared last Tuesday. You could find the poll there. Mm-hmm. Which shows that in swing states, a solid majority, over 60%, support the current amount or more aid to Ukraine. So again, it would be smart politics for Trump to jump on that. And it'll be smart politics for Biden to insure himself against such a jump by Trump by being bolder in supporting Ukraine. It is true that, from, say, the spring of 2022, right after the big invasion, support among Republicans for Ukraine has dropped, but that kind of has stopped. And again, another factor, which I haven't mentioned yet, which played a role in the outcome on the Hill and will play a larger role, is increasing awareness in the United States of the brutal repression that Russians have put on Protestants of all kinds,
right,
and for that matter, Catholics and non-Moscow Patriarchate Orthodox Christians in occupied Ukraine, murdered over like two dozen pastors, tortured even more, destroyed dozens of churches, because they consider, especially Protestants, to be agents of the United States. And of course, the fact that there are many evangelicals who support Trump, they're becoming aware of this. And I think this is going to be a factor which makes it harder for the ostriches in the Freedom Caucus to push their line of defeatism on Russia and Ukraine.
Because it has been based on a very, not surprising, but quite a peculiar view of Russia's place in the world as this great defender of something, which, of course, if you've ever set foot in the place, is categorically not true.
Well, that's been part of it. Of course, the other part is there are a lot of people, not just in the Freedom Caucus, but also among so-called foreign policy realists who are busy fighting the last war. And the last war were our failed intervention in the greater Middle East, from which we properly got the phrase of endless war, right? But the fact is that we have critical interests that are at stake in Ukraine because Putin wants to essentially undermine NATO, which is critical for our security and our prosperity. So people think that somehow this is like our failed interventions in Iraq and Afghanistan, failing to note, A, that Ukraine is competent as a partner in the way that the government in Kabul was not, and B, we're not fighting. All we're doing is sending aid.
Yeah, and you don't have to rebuild a nation here. The nation's there, right? They just need your
help. Correct.
Ambassador Herbst, as always, thank you.
My pleasure.